The major part of why we are moving into the digital television is that digital technology uses less spectrum than the analog technology.
Do you ever wonder about how industry developments may affect you? On this episode, we spend some time with Dr. Ntsibane, who has devoted more than 20-odd years in research about technology developments, and we uncovered why it's important for you to get involved in the fourth industrial revolution. He is currently the head of C4IR, a South African government initiative, which has entered into an affiliation agreement with the World Economic Forum to focus in accelerating the adoption of transformative technologies and effective regulation in the fourth industrial revolution.
Dr. Ntsibane, we really appreciate you taking your time to come down to Port Elizabeth and engage with us. As a way of introduction, can you just give us a bit of insight about who you are, where you come from, and where do you work, as a way of introduction to yourself?
So, you know, the introduction of yourself is always an interesting stuff. Yeah. No, maybe I'll start with what I studied. I studied computer science from undergrad. In fact, my undergrad was computer science and mathematics, and then I went into a master's in computer science.
Really? Where did you study your undergrad?
I studied my undergrad in Lesotho, right? And then I went to the UK to do my master's, then went to the US to do the PhD.
Oh, wow.
Now, the interesting part is that as I was doing the PhD, I then took a topic in electronic design, but developing the software that enables electronic design. So that's what I started to get into.
So the design packages, yes. or the firmware on the electronics?
The firmware on the packages. So what then I ended up doing as I was developing work in my PhD, I found that there was a language that was specified that is supposed to be a high-level language for design of electronic stuff.
Okay.
But there was no compiler for it.
Oh, wow.
So I needed to do some work on it. So I had to start by actually developing the compiler first.
Wow. That's basic first principles, right?
Yes, first principles first. And then I had a compiler. And then I did the optimization for how you can then deliver the circuit using the high-level language in that. So that was my part in the, you know, in my PhD. So I then decided, okay, let me just focus on the research alone and then focus on the research now. So what then happens now is that I spent many years on research and then managed the teams in research.
Was this under the university or was it?
No, as I was now in the CSIR.
Oh, so now you've already moved into CSIR.
Yeah. So at the CSIR, I started more as a more basic researcher, right? You know, in the levels, I was a senior researcher, and then I got promoted to principal researcher. Then I became a research group leader at the CSIR. Then became a competency area manager. So a competency area manager manages a number of research groups that are similar. So in that, but as I moved up, obviously, you start to move more into strategy now, right?
The CSIR and C4IR, I thought it was the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you get into, because now you are the head of the C4IR,
yeah.
Which is an initiative that is from the World Economic Forum. Can you talk to us about what that is and how GenderMark fits into that
into,
movement?
Into that. So maybe first I'll link the C4IR with the policy interest. Right, from where I have. So the C4IR, one of the first things that it focuses on is to look at what are the policy gaps that hinder the adoption of the 4IR technologies. Right. So I talked about just the telecommunications then. It's just one. But as you go into 4IR side, we can talk about what are the hindrances, the policy gaps that will, prevent you from having drones delivering packets or delivering anything or even using drones to fight wildfires. What are the gaps that are there in deploying AI in the society or in different applications? So these are some of the things that we look at. So the C4IR is really premised on accelerating the adoption of the 4IR technology. So the C4IR, unlike the CSIR, we are not developing new technologies. We are simply saying the technologies are there. Other people are developing these technologies, but there might be gaps in either the governance of those technologies that do not enable them to be adopted faster. Right.
And so that's
really the core of the work. And maybe you wanted to link it with the how it links with the World Economic Forum.
Yes.
So the World Economic Forum had established a center for the 4IR in San Francisco sometime in 2017 with the exact same purpose. Right? So when in South Africa we said we wanted to implement the 4IR program and we need to have a center that looks at enablement of the adoption. It was then a clear indication that maybe we can then partner with the World Economic Forum and be part of a network of centers that were being established across the world where we can then share the insights. There's no point in completely starting something from scratch when someone else has done the same. Of course, we can't simply plug in something that was done in the US and plug it into South Africa, it won't work. We have to then, as a center here, look at the local conditions. What else can we learn from what has happened in the US and then put it into work in the in South Africa? So that's where we link with the World Economic Forum as part of the number of centers that are peer centers that have the learnings together. But each of those centers, in their own countries, they work autonomously.
But collaboratively in learning. Lessons learned, yeah. What worked there, yeah. What didn't work.
Yeah, what worked there, what didn't work. So in South Africa, as a center in South Africa, we focus on creating an ecosystem of players from both government and industry. We bring in the academia, and together we then look at those particular gaps that I've talked about. How do we then work together to close those gaps? And we establish projects that then focuses on closing those gaps and enabling the adoption of the technologies. And that in a nutshell explains why we would be working in projects with companies like Gendermark and the companies like TK and HART that are based in this province and in this city.
So the C4IR, I heard you mention stuff about policy, about them trying to help policies, right? Change policies, write policies. And then how does the Presidential Commission fit into that, the Presidential Commission for the Fourth Industrial Revolution?
So I will just highlight that the Presidential Commission was established to develop a strategy for the country. And in a sense, as you develop the strategy for the country, you want to say, what are the priorities in the 4IR? We talk about 4IR, what are the priorities in the 4IR? So the commission did its work and published a report in 2020. That report established about 8 priorities. Now, one of those priorities is to look at the current policies and revise them to enable the adoption of the technologies. That's one of them. Others will include infrastructure, AI, and they will include advanced manufacturing, as well as using data for innovation and developing skills. So there are a number of them. There are eight of them. And then there's I think the seventh one is the one that talks about the policies, but the last one talks about having a coordinated approach, having a council that coordinates that. And that work is now being driven by a project management office at the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies. So we are actually working very closely with them. We have regular engagement with them to see how us as the people that are engaging much, much closely on a daily basis and running projects with the industry, how then we can help that implementation to go ahead. So in a sense, the commission itself has finished its work. The project management office is now doing the implementation of that strategy that has been developed in partnership with us and others in the whole ecosystem.
So maybe I can ask a two-part question. If having looked back now, the Presidential Commission was released in 2020. If you now, with 2 years of hindsight, what would you recommend differently, having learned what we've learned now in the last 2 years? And maybe your opinion on how's the implementation going?
Okay. So maybe let me start with the easier one.
Okay.
And the easier one will be if there's anything that I'll recommend differently.
Okay.
In a sense, most of the recommendations that are there, to me, I agree with them, right? Most of them. Because I think they cover the essential element. They establish what is it that we need to do. So I'll just highlight them this way, that it makes a recognition that we have to be in the AI discussion. Whether it's the regulations on AI that are being done globally or not, but we have to be part of that, because if we are not, we run a risk of AI, algorithms introducing the unfairness
and the
biases that can come with it. If we are not part of the team that is developing this thing, so we have to be part of it. So that's why having Artificial Intelligence Institute is an important element in that. But it also recognizes that we have to revitalize our manufacturing. And that's my understanding of why there's that one of Advanced Manufacturing Institute, because without manufacturing, we can't we can't really grow the economy. We'll continuously be digging up the minerals, shipping them out to someone else, and then buying the products back. So we have to revitalize manufacturing, and we have to say, how do we use the fourth industrial revolution to be able to revitalize that particular manufacturing, right? So that's very important in a sense. But this next thing that is highlighting there, and I'm only talking about three in details, recommendations. And I've talked about AI Institute, and I've talked about the manufacturing as a main thing. But one of the key things is to understand that everything is going digital. And with digital, there's a lot of data that is being generated everywhere. With everything that you do, you are generating data everywhere. And harnessing that data and releasing it for the innovators to then come up with applications that we don't even know. That's very important. And I think the government, having that particular recommendation, I think all the government in all different spheres of government needs to understand that data, it's more useful if it's actually shared and being harnessed and utilized, because other people are going to do that, and that the government does not have the full wisdom to be able to do that. So it's best to release it. The innovators are out there. There'll be a lot of entrepreneurs that will come in and, you know, use that data for the benefits of the whole society. Right. So that's very important for me. So those are, for me, those are the key things. And I wouldn't change anything around those. So I've said that I wouldn't change anything. Perhaps maybe the one thing would be to just change the narrative around what actually is 4IR. Because I think the definition that is used, it's sort of an idealistic definition, but it doesn't really have enough substance into it. When someone says 4IR is a fusion of your digital, physical and biological worlds, doesn't necessarily give enough. So I think we have to do enough to just say, what exactly do we mean? And for me, what I would have loved is to see us, you know, a little bit, you know, opening up a little bit to highlight that it is actually the use of a certain types of technology to advance the society and business. If we understand it that you are actually harnessing the power of technology, but it's actually the transformation in the society, and we highlight that everybody understands that it's a transformation of the society and the way the businesses work, which will transform the whole economy. Is harnessing of those particular technologies and say, these are the technologies that us as South Africa, we are going to focus on. As we said, we're going to focus on the technologies that enable the advanced manufacturing. We are going to focus on artificial intelligence as a specific technologies. And of course, we'll focus on infrastructure and maybe other technologies that are involved in the infrastructure. But that's the thing. But I think it's more about what is it and why is it it's important to go to be spending money on 4IR.
I'll give you my 2 cents, probably not worth much. When I went through the document, and maybe the way I'll describe it is that if we look at the title, I could have changed the name on the top to Singapore or India or Brazil or the US. So for me, there was a level. It is a really good document. It describes everything. There's nothing I disagree with. But I think the translation from that theory into what does it mean for me as a South African is missing. So I think they got off light, in my opinion, because they didn't do the hard work to say, okay, we know we need AI. We know we need to focus on policy. All of these things, that's clear. We knew that before the commission, right? What I was expecting out of the commission was, now that we know we need AI, what does it mean for the 75% youth unemployment in South Africa? How does that translate into revitalizing manufacturing? Because those are all nice things to say, but I was, to be honest, a little disappointed in the next step, because that's the hard part. And I was expecting, to be honest, a little bit more direction, because we want to play in the space, we want to play our part. And we take direction from that document that was produced, but there was no next step for me. To be honest, that was my opinion on that.
It's interesting you say that, Janesh, because what I was going to say to Doctor is, as a young person living in South Africa, my thinking is we know that innovation always goes before regulation, right? So but when you look at the average South African in South Africa. When you talk about 4IR and all the technologies that are involved, to them, they feel like they're not part of it. And it's not helping the society as what the Presidential Commission, when they release their strategy, they are hoping it does. So how do you engage the youth into changing the narrative and even being part of these technologies? Because I am having this fear now as I'm listening to you talk that it feels like we are behind all the guys that are leading this. And if AI is not regulated and it has the potential to be biased and harm us in the future, then it means that we are in trouble.
It feels like we are behind, right? But we're actually not behind.
I agree.
So, and maybe we need to fix that. Why is it that we feel that we are behind? Maybe it's because maybe the majority of the people feels they are outside. But in fact, we are not behind in terms of the innovations. Right? We are actually part of the leaders. And GenderMark is an example as a you know, innovator in that particular space, is one of the leading companies, not only here, but globally, right? And we have many examples. And just about 2 weeks or 3 weeks back, there was a launch of a report that looked at the AI innovation across the whole continent. We always thought that maybe Nigeria, maybe Kenya, and just that narrative that they are leading. But in actual fact, the majority of the innovators are in South Africa. The majority of the companies that are doing a lot of innovation in the AI space are in South Africa, and most of them are in the Gauteng province. So there is a lot that we are doing. Right? Perhaps maybe where you are coming to is, how is it that we don't know this? So that's the first part. But it needs to be known, right? And maybe whose responsibility is it to make sure that happens? It's all our responsibility.
That's why we have a podcast.
Yes.
to try help in that.
Sometimes part of it is that we don't have the regulations, right? So if you don't have the regulations, sometimes you find that certain things don't really get implemented as widely as they're supposed to be, because there's no guidance as the regulation guidance. So that's the next step from what you're talking about. So you're talking about that the document is there, is probably documenting what we already knew. But I think one thing that I had said is that we already knew this, but it sets the priorities.
Yeah.
Right. It has set the priorities. And I think this is where it's important that if we understand that this has set the priorities, then we said, how do we then start to implement that? And this is the next layer. This is where the layer where we are playing as a C4IR to say, let's look at then doing it instead of talking about it. What are the networks that we need to put in place? And what are the policies that we need to put in place such that this can work? So you take, for instance, something like IoT. At this particular stage, we don't have any policies that will hinder that. Now, how do we make sure that IoT gets implemented and most people get the benefit? And particularly when we have said manufacturing is one of our priorities. And this is precisely why the project that we took and we ended up working with the GenderMark was to look at how do we then bring the advantages of IoT that you can get the efficiencies in anything that you do through understanding the data that you already have, right? Understanding your own manufacturing plant better. And we bring that IoT into that. And we looked at this particular case and said the most of the manufacturers, if you talk about the numbers, the majority of them are small enterprises. So we focus specifically on that to say, let's focus on this. How can we bring all the people together that can be able to, to fast track the adoption of this particular technology? It's about adopting it. There's no policy hindrance. So we have to align everything. So we are here, in this city where we are engaging with you know, AIDC, who has the similar objective. How do we then bring all what we do? We this morning we also had a meeting with another agency of the Eastern Cape government, EXEC, to look at how do we actually fast track this together. We can demonstrate how technology works, working with the gender mark, demonstrate how it works, and we are demonstrating it now with the SMMEs that are manufacturing here in the city. How then do we all take that lesson and then make sure that the entire province then can protect its manufacturing base? And we know that from the manufacturing perspective, the bigger element in the province and maybe in the country is the automotive manufacturing. Let's protect that one first. Then we can bring others, but let's make sure that we don't lose where we already have an advantage.
Yeah.
So let's make sure that the efficiencies are there, because if we don't do that and our components manufacturers are not efficient, are not able to service the OEMs, the OEMs will go and get those services somewhere else and we'll be the ones that are the losers. So we do that to make sure that we protect the industries that we have, we increase the efficiencies in there, protect our manufacturers. And I think the partnership that we have with the GenderMark will ensure that that happens.
Yeah.
When you talk about the strategy and the adoption of 4IR, Yanesh, a couple of years ago, presented in the United Nations. Can you please talk to us about what you were presenting and that idea of how we're not supposed to be prescribing the principles that we learned or we take in European markets and just paste it in the African market?
Yeah, I think we've spoken about it a lot. I think that what we've been able to learn over the last number of years exporting our machines around the world is to really look at these technologies, advanced technologies, with an African lens on, because we're based here, right? And to understand that actually those technologies are actually just tools in a toolbox. And I can use those tools to do different things. And those tools are being used in the developed countries to solve their particular problems. And it's all centered around automation, high cost of labor, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't mean that we should copy and paste those tools and the methods that those tools are being used with into Africa, because we've got a different set of challenges. We've got unemployment, poverty, not enough money to automate. So that doesn't make sense. But those tools in my toolbox, I can reconfigure to do different things to help solve our particular problems. And that's what I tried to explain in the United Nations, but I'm not sure if it was understood.
So for me, if it's not understood in the United Nations, I can forgive them. But is it understood from a South African perspective by the people that are leading us?
I don't know. I haven't spoken to the guys that are leading us. But at least it's a good question, and that's why we're creating this podcast, right? We've spoken about the underlying reasons for creating this podcast is to stimulate the conversation, to say, from a GenderMark perspective, this is our opinion. From a C4IR perspective, that's your opinion. How do we find common ground? How do we change each other's opinions based on different experiences and then go together on a common platform? So that's why we want to have these conversations. It's to say, let's not wait for somebody else to start talking about it. We should go for it. And we talk to as many people as what we can.
I think what is interesting is it's below what he has said. I think what he has said is probably what we agree on, that the technologies is just a toolbox that we need to use according to our own needs, right? And it goes back to that issue of saying, we are if we take the province, we are a province that produces, is it about 45% of cars, right? And that goes with the parts for those. So we are a province that does that. So the question is, how do we use the technologies to make sure that we remain there or even increase our stake?
Exactly.
And that's what we said, but maybe below that could be that maybe the Germans are still doing the same thing. But for them, they can't do them with the labor that they have. They have a different labor profile. So automation becomes a priority for them. For us, it's not a priority. So how do we then use the same toolbox to be able to then still compete and maybe still out-compete with our labor profile? Yeah. So I think that's the conversation that we all need to have. And maybe the conversations that we have been having have not been deep enough to get to that level.
Yeah. I'll give you a simple example. So consumers are now demanding more variation in product. Use cars as an example. The number of variations of cars you see on the road are 20 times more than what it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You have an SUV, then you have a different type of SUV, then you have a big SUV, a small SUV, then you have a sedan, and then within each car, there's multiple color of seats, cockpits. The variations are now astronomical. And that doesn't lend itself to highly automated production lines. So our advantage could be, the thesis is, or the theory is, if we have high labor production lines, we can adapt the product that's being built much more flexibly and much quicker than a highly automated line. Mm. So we should be playing to our advantage to say, listen, we're in South Africa, we can make any variation of your car, just bring it here, we make it. Mm. Whereas in a highly automated production line, to change from one variant to another costs time, costs a huge amount of money, and it becomes inflexible. So that's a simple example. The market is demanding high flexibility, high variation. So we should align our weakness, turn it into a strength to that high variation, which means, as a simple analogy of the opportunities, right? As opposed to automating it and then having the same problem of not being able to be flexible. If that answers your question.
And by the way, we don't have all the answers.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why we need to be listening to each other and partnering, because as we are talking here, he might have a solution already of saying, how do we actually not just keep our labor profile, but maybe increase the number of people that are in employment and increase the number of companies that participate in this by harnessing the technologies. So I may not have that answer, and I may be looking for him, and I think the engagement between ourselves is going to continue so that we can be able to find that answer and recommend that particular way of adoption of the technology, which enables us to create more jobs as opposed to lose jobs. And we'll understand that someone who will be focusing a lot more on automation than on digitization of the services is someone that may be having a different labor profile, that may not have enough labor, but that still wants to play in this game. So you don't have enough labor, but you still want to be able to produce. Obviously, you will have to find something to substitute those people. So we shouldn't necessarily think that that is a silver bullet just because it worked for them.
Exactly.
It's a silver bullet for us. They will beat us at that game because this is their game.
Yeah.
And we will be stuck where we don't have people working in the factories.
Well, nobody to buy the cars.
and those people will be more efficient at doing that than us. Whereas if we do harness our strength with our labor and be able to do that, that's what we can get.
If you have a factory in a European market and a factory in South Africa, exactly what you're speaking about, Janesh, that has a high volume production, and in our case it has many people, will you be able to beat the automation in terms of input output number? So if a factory wants to produce 5,000 units a day, can you do that with more people in the factory as opposed to more automation? That's the first question.
My opinion is yes.
With more people and less automation, okay?
So I was going to say, ask him. he knows more about producing, the factory work than I do.
Yeah. So I think that what what we should do is obviously try to create jobs that are safe, and some things a robot will do more efficiently than a human. And there's some things that a human will do more efficiently than a robot. And I think it's about finding the balance. And for me, the main driver for automation in our context should be safety and ergonomics. If it's not safe and it's not ergonomic for a human to do it, let's automate. However, if there's flexibility that a human can bring, like picking a red gear knob versus a blue gear knob, it's difficult for a robot to do that. So I might as well use a human, create an opportunity to do that. And then when a blue gear knob comes along, it's easy for me to create a digital instruction to say, please pick the blue knob, for example. So I think that 100% yes. And remember, before we had huge volumes of automation, we're still making lots of cars with people. It's just that the demand from a developed country perspective was that people were getting more expensive. So that's why the people were being removed off production lines, not because they couldn't do it. The second question I wanted to ask is a complete deviation. We spoke about it last night, actually. Is there was a big debate around the Donald Trump telling Huawei that he's not allowed to do work, they are not allowed to do work in the US around this whole 5G thing. And I never understood the details around it until you explained it to me yesterday. And I think that I'd like Goodwill and the rest of the people watching to understand the layers underneath that are really important to understand why that decision was taken.
Why I think the decision was
yes. taken. Yeah, why you think the decision was your opinion on yeah. why the decision
why,
was taken.
Why the decision was taken. Yeah. So the 5G. So I think the bigger understanding should be that below the spectrum layer where we know that the 5G spectrum will be allocated and so on, there's the architecture of the network itself. And the developments in the architecture of the 5G has been that a lot more of the control of the network is moving towards the cloud in what is called, it's virtualizing the network. Let me put it in general like that, software-defined networks. So you are getting more of the control of the network, more towards the cloud side than it was before. So as you move from 4G to 5G, there's more and more and more of that control being moved to the cloud, which then means there's a lot more communication between the rest of the parts of the network into the cloud.
Yeah. I'm following you 100% because it's an interest of mine as well. But maybe we just take a step back and maybe explain what is the spectrum and why it's so important to us.
Okay. So
taking you back to your lecturing days. There's an exam afterwards.
And I'm the student.
Yes.
So
you must stand up and present afterwards.
So I don't have a definition of spectrum. And maybe it's not important, but what's important is what spectrum enables. So maybe it's better to do it with an illustration that when you take your phone, right, the phone connects to some infrastructure somewhere, right? You see this phone mast there. In order for that phone to know which mast to connect to, and to be able to establish that connection, it has to be tuned to a particular frequency. It's more like tuning your radio, your TV. It has to tune to that. So that that is what is called the radio frequency spectrum. You know, and it has the certain number of channels. So your phone will know that I tune on this channel. If I tune on this channel, I connect to that particular tower, and that tower will give me either 4G or 3G, or a GSM connection, and maybe all of them at the same time, right? So you connect there, so your phone will have a number of antennas built into them that will connect there, and they use the spectrum to do that.
And you're doing research on how to develop that, the connection.
Yeah, so let me just finish by saying that, okay, so there's the televisions do the same way, the radios do the same thing, so there are many other uses. So when you are at home, and you have an ADT connection, they also use the same spectrum to connect to the ADT office, so that when you press the alarm, ADT will know and then respond. So all of those are the uses of spectrum. So what we're looking at is this spectrum really a scarce commodity, or it is how it is being licensed to users that makes it scarce? So that was the research question that we're looking at.
So the spectrum in a simple term is those frequencies that all our devices, whether it be your TV, your radio, your alarm system at home, or your smartphone, talk different frequencies to those systems. And there's a band of different frequencies. And that band is what you call the spectrum. So some spectrum will be allocated to TV, radio, cell phones, etc., etc.
So it's like the electromagnetic spectrum, right?
Yes. So, but because the communication only works at certain frequencies. So there's a finite number of frequencies you can use. So if Vodacom, you want to use all the frequencies, MTN has nothing. So it becomes a finite commodity that you have to manage somehow. So that's the spectrum and the limited amount of frequencies available.
I see.
So obviously what happens is that there's spectrum that is reserved for television. Right. And this agreement is done at the International Telecommunications Union by all countries to say this spectrum is reserved for television. This one is reserved for mobile communication. This one is reserved for other communications like Wi-Fi and others. This one is reserved for this. So those are the decisions that are made. But if the technology that you are using in that particular spectrum is not efficient in using the spectrum, there'll be a lot of spectrum that is left that is not used. It might be reserved for that, but it is not used. So what we then looked at that time is that the television planning, right? Whether the current analog one or whether you're going into the digital one, it's not efficiently using spectrum. There's a lot of spectrum that lies idle, and that is very good spectrum for wireless communication, but it's not being used. So what we then that brought me into the policy space to say, okay, let me engage with the regulator, and then we do the research. But I then had the team that is doing the research on how to utilize that spectrum in a way that doesn't interfere with your television, but they can use it to communicate and have people have internet on that spectrum. So the team is doing that. And I then engage with the regulator to say, there are no regulations that allow us to dynamically access spectrum and use it for better use. And the regulator then agreed that we should actually go into that particular mode. But I have to demonstrate to them first that the technology won't be harmful to television. Which is our team did that. And in 2012, we went working with Google. We had a project in Cape Town, which actually proved a lot of things about the technology. And the report that we produced from there was used by the US regulator to fine tune their dynamic spectrum regulation. And we have one in South Africa that we introduced after that project. As a result of that project, that's what actually brought me into the governance space and have interest in that, to say you can actually prove this thing using the technology. So then you go into the governance, because without that, those regulations, even though technically we could prove it and other people use it, without those regulations, South Africa will not have those TV white spaces networks. And today we have the TV white spaces networks that actually dynamically look at where spectrum is not used, take the spectrum and then assign it to a network, and the network can provide fast internet in a spectrum that would have otherwise remained idle all the time.
So if I just try to understand what you guys were able to achieve, was take existing TV frequencies that were allocated for TV, which is obviously not being fully utilized.
Yes.
There was capacity and create technology that can dynamically see where is the gap, use that gap for high-speed internet, and then obviously make better use of that spectrum. Because if I remember correctly, the talk was to stop using that TV network and change to something completely different. And that would have been a huge change and upheaval. So you found a way to use both to create or to better utilize the network, right? Yeah.
So it's there. So this is, we're talking about analog television, like moving to digital television. That is still going ahead.
Okay.
But what usually is not being said is that in the way that even the digital networks are planned in South Africa and in many countries, it still leaves a lot of spectrum not used.
So will they use the same spectrum for digital TV?
They will use the same spectrum for digital
TV. But it's not digital.
No. They will use the same spectrum for digital TV, even in the provinces where now analog has been switched off, is now digital television.
So the
spectrum is still left in between the TV spaces.
So the opportunity still remains.
The opportunity remains. Yeah. It's bigger when it's analog. When you go to digital, it's still there.
Okay.
Yeah. But what's the difference between analog and digital television? I think I'm blunt now.
No. It's a good question.
Okay. It's a good question there to talk about that. Let me see what's the easier way of explaining it. So the analog television, it's in a sense the original type of communication where you are actually, you know, transmitting the pictures in their original form, right? And in digital, you then the digitized word is where you have ones and zeros, right? You then transmit the pictures in a transformed digital form. And what does happen in that particular case is that sometimes it even enhances the quality of the picture.
There's no loss.
As you are doing that, you have lower losses and that. But the problem also that comes with that is that you don't have a fuzzy picture, right? Okay, so it's a problem and a good thing that you don't have a fuzzy picture. So the digital television comes with very clean picture, right? Because it's either the picture is there or not. So you don't have in between. So if you are sort of at the edge of the network, you actually completely lose the connection.
It's one or zero.
Yeah. You either get a good connection or you don't get a connection. Whereas with analog TV, as you go to the edge of the network, you get a fuzzy, you can see some with lines and all of those, but you can still see something. Yeah. So with the digital one is always the cleaner one with that. So that's where we are doing it. But the major part of why we are moving into the digital television is that digital technology uses less spectrum than the analog technology. So that's the main reason why there was this shift, that you can actually get more channels, more television channels in one spectrum band, as opposed to having just one digital television channel in one spectrum band. You actually have up to 12 in that particular one. So it's a factor of 12 to get there. So it's a much more efficient way of using spectrum.
Yeah.
So it starts to become key who owns that cloud and where. And if you are laws do not allow such amount of data that is a control of your critical infrastructure to be then shared with other countries, and whether you trust those guys or not, you then have to make those decisions. So in my opinion, the US made the decision purely based on the issue of the trust relationship that they have with China as a country, and said it cannot be the case that the country that they don't trust, they can allow a company from a country that they don't trust to be able to have a lot, so much data about their infrastructure.
But why was it different between 4G and 5G? That was interesting for me.
So the interesting element, I think, goes back to that it's again that issue that from the 4G perspective, the architecture was not that.
Yeah. So if I understood correctly, it's more hardware controlled.
More hardware controlled.
Settings are happening on the hardware, and the software is running on the hardware.
Mm.
And if I understood correctly, with 5G antennas and the 5G network, a lot of that software is now outsourced into a centralized control in the cloud, which means that you have one cloud operate or one application controlling a whole network, essentially.
So the brain of the network starts to move to the cloud, whereas previously the brain of the network is distributed across the hardware that is sitting there. So your hardware that is sitting here would be the one that would be dealing with the routing decisions. But the routing decisions, if they are moved more towards the cloud in what is now called the software-defined networks, and that is deployed more in the 5G perspective than in the 4G, you start to have heightened issue around who then controls that, because then a lot of data has to be streamed to that cloud. And again, that's where that trust comes in, that if this is the owner of the cloud, let's face it, there are four major players that gives us the network, the mobile networks that we have globally. And the number one is Huawei, followed not closely, but by some distance. Followed by the two European players, Ericsson and Nokia. And then some distance behind that, you will have ZTE, which is also Chinese. So there are two Chinese in those top four, and then two Europeans. So obviously you'll go with who you trust, right? So the Europeans will trust the Europeans, and maybe the Americans will trust the Americans. And as I've just gave you those four, it just tells you, you don't have an African one there, right? So if we were to just take a decision purely based on saying we need to have our own, we will not have a network. If today we were to decide we want to take a side in this, and maybe we agree with the US and we trust the US and we want to chase away Huawei, the biggest in terms of our networks currently, Huawei has built more of those than any other. So it's the majority.
These networks are the telecommunication networks.
Telecommunication networks.
What are we talking about?
The cell phone networks.
Yeah, the cell phone networks. So the phones that you use connect to the cell phone networks. And here we're not talking about the phones. We're talking about the cell phone networks. Yeah.
The infrastructure.
Yeah. I believe that the issue of the phones in the US was just brought in because it's just Huawei. But it was not the issue. The issue is the network. And Huawei is the leader in building the mobile networks.
So even your Apples are using the same...
Yeah, the antennas that you see on the roads.
Yeah.
In South Africa, most of them are Huawei.
And have been for the longest of time.
Yeah, have been
before the Huawei mobile phone started being.
Yeah, yeah, the those networks were here before the.
But again, this is the reason why Nokia in terms of the phones, it's almost nowhere, right? But Nokia is actually a big player. I think it's the second biggest in the mobile infrastructure business. Has continued, whilst the phones disappeared from the market. Nokia continued, and it's actually, I can't remember exactly which one is bigger between Nokia and Ericsson, but I think Nokia is bigger, that it may be bigger than Ericsson. But again, even for the phones, you know that Ericsson used to have phones, and they also disappeared from the market, but actually on the infrastructure, those two are still the very, very big players.
So question for me, so if, let's say I'm a mobile network, Vodacom, MTN, Rain, any of these guys, I'm going to set up my infrastructure. Let's say I choose Huawei. Does that control not sit with Vodacom? How does it not sit with Vodacom or MTN, but that control, what you're suggesting is, sits actually more with Huawei?
In a sense, you can as an operator to say that the biggest control stays with me. But in fact, that's not what is happening.
Okay.
What you see is that you have, it's a contracting issue, and maybe it's also how the vendors sell.
The pricing model.
Yeah, the equipment. Is that they have a lot of management services on top of that. And this is the reason why Huawei is so big. I mean, we have big staff complement in the country. It's not a sales office.
Yeah.
They have actually their engineers sitting there because they actually do provide continuous services on the infrastructure that they have. And that's the same thing with Nokia, that's the same thing with Ericsson. They actually provide those particular services. And this is the model that actually happens, not just a South African thing. It happens everywhere else. So that's the issue, that is the case. It's possible to do it, but it's...
It'll cost more.
It costs more.
If you have to do it yourself.
Yeah.
As a network provider.
But also think about it. Most of the network providers, in fact, all of them, never have one OEM on their networks. They always, at least when they go, they always at least have two, right? One building a network in this area, one building a network in this area, right? If you were to do all the management yourself, it means your technicians have to be proficient in both of those, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you say... most of the management or a certain level of the management of the network remains with the OEMs. They have specialists in their own, and the other ones have specialists in their own. And you know, that's the really the way that the game works.
I mean, it makes sense, but when it becomes a critical infrastructure for a country to survive, because if the network, somebody says, okay, we switch them off, we're dead, right? So now that power sits with two private organizations or three private organizations. Because imagine our networks, our internet just stops.
So Vodacom, MTN, and all of those guys, Telkom, what are they if they are buying the stuff from Huawei as well?
They're buying the hardware, right?
They have the hardware, and of course they have the client relationship with you. And they manage, they do have a lot of their data centers and the customer information that they have. But the actual infrastructure that they have there, they still also own it, right?
Yeah.
But they have someone else servicing.
So
the thing is, you see that someone who's servicing it has access to it and can have access to some control information. In fact, have access to a lot of control information. To gain that particular control, is there something that we can do?
Yeah. Well, other than making friends with everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So as a closing statement, Doc, I just want to know, what do you hope to achieve as the head of the C4IR in the next 10 years? What is in the most ideal when the start happens? Because now you said we're on your marks. So when the start happens, what key role do you want to play as an initiative or a forum?
Yeah, tough one. There are two key things, right? Maybe that I would like to see. The first one is, I would like really to see our manufacturing go up. Our manufacturing output increases. Whether it's in the automotive or in any other sector, and see more efficiencies coming in that manufacturing base by deployment of these particular technologies. And a greater percentage of those solutions being developed in the country. You know, with companies like Gendermark and others providing those solutions, as a greater percentage of those solutions being made in the country. That's that. And this is the manufacturing aspect. And in fact, I'll have to highlight that manufacturing will always be number one, that we should actually increase our manufacturing output. The related to that, with what I would call Industry 4.0, which will be digitization of many industries, not just the manufacturing, that energy security we have, and we begin to use the same technology to be able to maintain our power plants, that we, similar technologies that we use for maintaining the machinery in the factory floor. We use a similar type of technology to then maintain our power plants and have better energy security, and be able to utilize the minerals that comes from our soil to plow them more into our manufacturing base. And if we can use the technologies that we have to be able to fast track that, that's what I would like to see happening in those next 10 years. That's the first part. The second part would be for us to start now playing more into the usage of data in other areas, whether it's better use of data in the back office, in making sure that when you appoint people, you use the same technologies to be able to do even a thorough check of the people and verification, maybe deploying some AI in the back office, such that you don't end up with a situation where we were told that a huge percentage of government employees don't qualify for the jobs that they are in. So we'll remove those types of inefficiencies that will creep in where there could be favoritism, but use the technology to be able to align those. Use the technology to be able to then do better procurement and more transparency as we do the procurement, which will eliminate the corruption that you see. Because I believe that you have corruption where you don't have visibility. As soon as you know that someone can see what you do, and this will remain in the record, you'll be less likely to be to do the corrupt behavior. But if you know that you can hide it, you can do that. So we use the technologies to be able to bring more transparencies in the operations that we do, whether it's procurement, it's our financial management, it's our human resource management, and in many other areas. I would only put those two. Maybe I have others, but one is to boost that Industry 4.0 in a number of productive sectors. And the second thing is to be able to use these technologies to digitally transform many of our back office processes, supply chains, and all those.
That's awesome. Yeah. Hopefully we can do that, because I think we'll have a better place.
So that's why I signed up for the CIFOIA. Makes whether sense. That will happen or not, but that's why I signed up for the CIFOIA.
Wow. Thank you very much for spending time with us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you for hosting me.
Yeah, pleasure.